Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Scott Hahn, who is the best-selling author of a dozen books, including Signs of Life, The Lamb's Supper, and Reasons to Believe. He serves as the chair of Biblical Theology and Liturgical Proclamation at St. Vincent Seminary in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and as Professor of Theology and Scripture at the Franciscan University at Steubenville. In the internationally renowned lecturer, Dr. Hahn is founder and president of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. We're going inside the pages of Dr. Hahn's book, Many Are Called, Rediscovering the Glory of the Priesthood, published by Doubleday Religion. Dr. Scott Hahn, it is just a delight to have you with us today. Thank you so much for putting us into your very busy schedule.
It's wonderful to be back together again with you, Chris. I look forward to these times very much.
Many Are Called is such an important work. I am so glad that you have this available for, in particular, priests, but also for us lay people, the pew people, who really need to have an appreciation of our priesthood.
I agree. You know, I am so grateful for two things. Number one, the priesthood. Mm-hmm. Number two, the year of the priest that has just passed, because that year was so needed. I don't think Pope Benedict realized it at the time he called it, that this would end up becoming a year of savage attacks and misrepresentations upon our spiritual fathers. And so I can't help but think that the Holy Spirit led to this decision just in the nick of divine timing. And I wanted to do this book for a long time. I remember going back to the early 90s, giving a series of talks to hundreds of priests where I teach here at Franciscan University of Steubenville. Mm-hmm. And it was a covenant theology of the priesthood. And so I was focusing on the priest as father, the priest as brother, the priest as son, and the priest as bridegroom. And in those talks, I was just seeing more and more clearly in my prayer and preparation that these guys are like providers, they're protectors, they're breadwinners, they're warriors. They're everything. I mean, mm-hmm. they really are in the church what I am in my own family. And so I wanted to do this. And then, you know, of course, I kept putting it off. And then the year of the priest came, and I thought, there is no excuse. I've got to do this. And hopefully the graces of the year will produce some good fruit.
I think you come from a very unique perspective. You were at one point in your life a Presbyterian pastor.
That's right. An evangelical with very strong Calvinist convictions, and I must say, even now, a quarter century after becoming Catholic, I am grateful to God for all of the good that was given to me through my formation. I feel as though becoming Catholic was just a matter of addition and not really subtraction. It was just clarifying and correcting a few things, but one of those things that probably needed to be clarified and corrected was an exclusive focus on Jesus Christ the priest, mm-hmm. Jesus Christ our high priest. You know, and I thought, well, wait a minute. If Christ is our priest, then what business do we have with other priests? And so the Catholics are clearly wrong. But there were three considerations that just struck me from the Bible. The first one was, well, Aaron was the high priest, but that didn't exclude his sons from being priests. In fact, that was the source of their priesthood. Mm-hmm. So they shared or participated in his high priesthood as priests, just as the Levites did a little lower down the rung. You know, and so when you look at Jesus and how he speaks to the disciples before his death and resurrection, he calls them my children. Throughout the farewell discourse in John 13 through 17, where he's consecrating himself precisely as a high priest, and then he turns around and uses that special Greek word agiadzein, he consecrates them. It's the technical term used for ordaining priests under the high priest. Mm-hmm. The second consideration was, you know, just because Jesus is the bridegroom doesn't exclude me from marrying Kimberly. In fact, if anything, it invests my own status as the bridegroom and husband of my bride with an even deeper meaning. And then now I'm called to reflect the love and the sacrifice of Jesus to Kimberly. And so it isn't a tug of war. It isn't an either or. You know, and the third consideration is when you look at how it is that Jesus established the church, it follows the exact same pattern by which Moses established the Old Testament Church of Israel. You know, he appointed 12 princes and then 70 elders, and Jesus, in, you know, gathering a multitude of followers, also selected 12 disciples, and then 70 additional. And as you consider the development of the church in the book of Acts, it follows the same way as it did under Jesus' leadership in the gospel. In Luke 1, you have the drawing of lots by which Zechariah is selected as the priest who offers the incense, and that's where he gets the oracle, the annunciation of John the Baptist's birth. And then in Acts 1, the sequel that Luke wrote, you have Peter determining that once again lots will be drawn in order to find Judas's replacement. Well, that's the way in which you actually go about identifying the next priest in line. So for these and other reasons, I came to realize why it was such a consensus in the first three or four centuries that the early churches recognized without any debate that there is this priestly ministry precisely because Jesus intended it and because that's what you need to really renew the covenant through the sacrifice and offering of the Eucharist.
Well, and as you point out so beautifully in the book too, I appreciate the fact because of those factors, it's not just a job. It truly does change the character of their innermost being.
Right. You know, the one thing I really enjoy doing is addressing priests for the purpose of thanking them and encouraging them. In the last 2 weeks, I've had a couple of opportunities to address a few hundred priests. And I use my own fatherhood according to the flesh, as St. Paul puts it in Romans 4, to encourage them in their own fatherhood according to the Holy Spirit, as Pope John Paul and Pope Benedict have recently described the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that I am a father is so much more than I am a professor or I am a lecturer or I am a writer. I mean, one thing is an occupation. The other thing is a vocation. My calling to be a father means that I am available 24/7, but I'm not just like a doctor on call. I am available in the sense that I am present to my family and to my kids. You know, so even when I'm at work, you know, if I get a call, you know, I know that I have to, well, you know, I was teaching a Bible study recently, and one of my sons was rushed to the hospital. And it wasn't like I stood there thinking, okay, now, let me assess these priorities. Should I stay or should I go?
Mm-hmm.
I was out the door and breaking every speed limit on no time.
Good for you.
You know, and I want to instill in them a father's heart. And what I find is that God has already done that time and again. Young priests, old priests, and priests in between develop this sense of spiritual fatherhood in similar ways to how I've kind of grown in 30 years in my own fatherhood.
You know, Scott, there's a term that's used a lot now in the church, and it's called ministry. And a very important term, but in many parishes now we have everything from hospitality ministry to car ministry to this ministry, and I'm not trying to belittle that, but in its truest sense, the priesthood was designed for ministry in its most specific sense.
You pinpointed something that really fits into a larger category. You know, it's ironic because, you know, in becoming a Catholic, and in talking to cradle Catholics, I'm often looked at, you know, sort of like, oh, man, you still have your evangelical dialect. You know, you might speak Catholic language, but in a kind of Protestant manner. And, you know, I acknowledge that. I suspect that it's a little bit less now after 25 years than it was, say, after 5. But this is one of those areas where cradle Catholics, just by living in America, surrounded by a much larger or louder evangelical Protestant subculture, they've really kind of assimilated things that are not entirely consistent with their own Catholic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Because lay people, by virtue of their baptism and confirmation, are called upon to be apostles. And as such, they do apostolate. As Vatican II reminded us, we are to go out and sanctify the temporal order, which is not the same as going into the sanctuary and sort of serving as sacramental functionaries under the bishops, priests, and deacons.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the clergy. We are the laity. We are inseparably united, but completely distinct. And so when you look at the term ministry, it's really interchangeable with the term liturgy, and it has to do with the sacraments, and especially the Eucharist, and the sacrificial and communion aspects of that. Now, we can be grateful for the countless souls who have really dedicated themselves to hospital visitations on behalf of the priests, to bring communion and that sort of thing. But I do believe we have to renew our own sense of identity as lay people. And we have, according to the scriptures and according to the official teachings of the church, You know, the priesthood of the lay faithful is to go out and sanctify the temporal order. The priesthood of the ministers, the ministerial priesthood, is what sanctifies bread and wine and turns it into Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity. The two of the, you know, those two ministries, again, are inseparably connected. And you can see that in the Mass, because when we bring forth the bread and the wine in the offertory, that is the climax of the priesthood of the faithful. That represents sort of how our own labor is ordered to the liturgy. But what we're offering at that point is bread and wine. The priest takes it and turns around and uses his ministerial priesthood and the powers that are contained therein. And again, we've learned this. I hope we really get it down more, even more deeply, that the ministerial priesthood differs from the common priesthood, not by degree, but in kind. It's an entirely different kind of priesthood, which is why they don't just turn the bread and wine into the best tasting wine and really fresh bread. They turn it into nothing less than Jesus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, clarifying that distinction will help us to understand, wow, with the grace that we receive through the sacraments administered by the ministerial priests, we can go out into the world and truly not just sanitize society, but sanctify it, make it holy, not just a little cleaner than it was, say, a decade or two ago. And for the last 50 or 60 years, I think the confusion has contributed to the demise of society and its secularization, because lay people, instead of sanctifying the temporal order, have kind of relegated the temporal order to secularists, mm-hmm. and they've been only too happy to kind of take it over. And I think this is the time now for us to really take the power that we receive from our priests and go forth and really fulfill our own lay priestly vocation.
It's such an extraordinary time, but it goes back to that vocabulary, which we kind of lost a sense of, and even a term like hierarchy. Ooh, Scott, in the United States in particular, we don't like that vertical. We do not like that term hierarchy, do we?
It goes way back to the revolution when our motto was, we serve no sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're right about that, but I think we can tame that wild term because I think we assume that hierarchy is sort of the opposite of our society. It's clearly different than our society because our society tends to prize and institutionalize equality in a different way. But I would say this, that when you look at hierarchy and you trace it back to its etymology, it simply means sacred order. And so the connotations that people have with hierarchy, oh, they might think of just nothing more than this big impersonal corporation, or worse, you know, the Nazi Party or the Communists and that sort of thing, and the kind of hierarchy that imposes all sorts of brutalities upon people. But the notion of hierarchy is really traceable back into the inner life of God, where the Father doesn't lord it over the Son. He makes his life a gift of fatherly love, and the Son images that by returning that love, and the bond of their love is the Holy Spirit. And that just spills out and overflows. You know, there are 9 choirs of angels from the seraphim and the cherubim all the way down to Numbers 8 and 9, the archangels and the angels. And what's happening there is not that, you know, the upper levels have 90%, the lower levels only have 30 or 40%. They all receive 100% of God's love, God's life. And the ones who are above pour it out to those who are beneath, which is why the Pope loves the title the servant of the servants of Christ, because that's the true nature of hierarchy. It's a service of love. In a family, that's what parents ought to be doing, sacrificing more than their kids and for their kids.
Beautiful. We're talking with Dr. Scott Hahn about his book, Many Are Called, Rediscovering the Glory of the Priesthood. One of the things that, again, every time I read one of your books, Scott, it doesn't matter if I've read it a dozen times, there's always something new that I glean. And did I know that there was a connection between Adam and the ordination, that Adam was in some ways the very first to be ordained? But he kind of made a mistake there. He kind of blew that.
I mean, that's an important point that is often overlooked. And yet the closer we get to our tradition, especially the patristic voices of the early church, and even the closer we get to the rabbinic interpretive tradition that predates Christianity, the more we'll recognize what a commonplace it was to see that in Genesis 1, the reason why it's described as God creating the world in 6 days is just in time for him to consecrate it on the seventh. That's the Sabbath. And so for ancient Jews, they would see the world not as something that took literal 24-hour days to create, but as a temple, just as Solomon created the temple in 7 years, dedicated in the seventh month. But if the cosmos in Genesis 1, the creation, is a temple, the only way Jews could understand something to be a temple is if there's a sanctuary. Well, then look in Genesis 2, and the Garden of Eden is described with terms and images that are exactly duplicated in the description of the Holy of Holies in the book of Exodus, which means that Adam is to this cosmic temple of creation what Aaron is in the book of Exodus with the tabernacle. Adam is the high priest of humanity, just as Aaron was the high priest of Israel. And so the tasks that are given to Adam are often translated to till and keep the garden. Mm-hmm. But those words, Avodah and Shamar, along with the other terms that are found in the Hebrew version of Genesis 2, are only found elsewhere in describing the priestly duties, the job description of Aaron and the Levites. And that is why you see then that Adam's sin is more than just a transgression. It really is a desecration. And when he's cast out of the garden along with Eve, the two cherubim that are posted there in Genesis 3 are only found elsewhere in the description of the Holy of Holies, where the two cherubim overshadow the Ark of the Covenant and form the mercy seat. And so when you enter the Holy of Holies, in effect, you are re-entering Edenic paradise. You're undoing the damage that was caused when Adam committed this original sin that we have all contracted.
Reclaiming our appreciation of that great gift of holy orders for all of us is so important.
It really is. You know, I can hear the echo of what I've been sharing with you, and you know, I can also feel the residual effects of a professor who has not been in the classroom now for almost 2 months, and how it's coming out a little more academic, you know, than I wanted to, because in this book it's more anecdotal than it is academic. Mm-hmm. You know, I begin with one of my favorite experiences of a fellow named Joe Freedy, now Father Joe, mm-hmm. and how he was a star quarterback for SUNY Buffalo and the Bulls, who are an NCAA division team. And, I mean, his statistics put him up there with two other college quarterbacks who were superstars, Ben Roethlisberger and Byron Leftwich. And I only found out about Joe when I got a word from his parents that he had read The Lamb's Supper. Mm-hmm. And what he told them, apparently, in a phone call was, I've read a book that makes me want to put down my playbook and really get into action, because I'm finding out what's really happening in the Mass, and I want to be a part of that. Wow. Because it's even more exciting than winning football games. And so, you know, Father Joe has become one of the most dynamic priests in the area. I'm in Steubenville, Ohio, but he's in Pittsburgh, just about a half hour away. And it's been exciting to see how the Lord has harnessed all of these male hormones that that all men have. But, I mean, Joe especially had them, you know, as a star quarterback and as a big man on campus and all the rest. But I think he just exemplifies something that is becoming much more common, that men who are seeking fulfillment are really discovering the lies of our society, that fulfillment only comes through drinking drugs and sex and that kind of stuff, or making more money and having more women, you know, and just more and more prestige and power. That is so empty at the end of the day. And yet this notion of fatherhood as sacrifice, this notion of fatherhood as life-giving love, self-gift, this is the only thing that fulfills. Nothing in my life is harder than fatherhood. Nothing is more fulfilling. And Father Joe knows that in ways I suspect I might never know. And countless others do, too. I've just encountered so many priests who, as men, are not less fulfilled than me, but in so many ways, more fulfilled. It isn't reducible down to kind of, you know, sexual satisfaction. It really has much more to do with who we are as persons, who we are as men, and how God calls us and empowers us to sacrifice and to love and to find our life by giving it.
Helping us to identify ourselves in wholeness, that's essentially your work. There has just been the totality that has given us a fullness, a wholeness of who we are as God's children.
Well, I'm grateful for that. I really am. And I hope that it has a feedback loop effect as well on fathers who are in families which are identified by the church officially as a domestic church. You know, and so just as priests are fathers in the parish, so fathers are priests in their home, and they ought to be leading through sacrifice. You know, and they ought to be disciplining more through instruction by example and that sort of thing than just simply, you know, a juridical hearing where punishments are meted out or orders are given. There's a place for authority and punishment, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that we all grow as a result of it when it's done right. But I really do hope and pray that young men might get this book and read it and realize, wow, you know, before the priesthood didn't have any attraction, but that's only because I didn't understand it. It wasn't because I wasn't called. And not only that, but I think we can give it to our priests and our young men, but we can also give it to others, lay people, lay men, but also lay women, because I do think this one sacrament, Holy Orders, is arguably the most underrated and underappreciated of the seven.
Oh.
And it's really time that the fruit of the year of the priest gets harvested and enjoyed by all.
I would echo that 100%, Scott, because I encounter many seminarians, many just by virtue of the Institute for Priestly Formation, which gathers so many of our seminarians, I think over 175 this last summer here in Omaha. And the overwhelming statement that they'll make to me is that the opposition that they've had, if there is some opposition, comes from family members, and in particular parents, who really do not appreciate what it is that their sons, this calling that God has placed in their sons' hearts, what it means. For those parents who eventually do come to understand that, what a blessing for them to have this beautiful vocation in their child's life. But for many men, they're discouraged and pushed away by parents who just, they really don't understand it, Scott.
Well, you know, there's a reason for that. I mean, I guess there are two sets of reasons. One set of reasons might be rooted in unbelief or in a kind of overly secularized worldview, and where they just want grandkids. They don't really recognize the need for the supernatural. But the good set of reasons is because the parents are really called to grow in holiness by sharing in the sacrifice of whatever vocations God gives their kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have six kids. The first two boys are married, and my daughter is open but not drawn yet to the religious life. My next son, Jeremiah, is quite open to the priest of the religious life. But I mean, it's really hard at times for us as parents to see our kids kind of having to go through the same steps, the same hardships, the same sacrifices, the same mistakes that we made, you know. And our parents didn't always come in and just kind of set us straight. They allowed us to make mistakes, and I realize now what a sacrifice that was to kind of stand by quietly while we learned life's lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that that is even truer for parents when it comes to the fulfillment that their boys will experience through responding with a yes to God's calling to the priesthood. They will come to see the nature of life, the nature of love, the nature of their own parenthood in ways that will end up kind of glowing with a supernatural meaning, a much, much deeper meaning. And the fact is they are going to have to wrestle with it the same way their sons will. But if they wrestle with it and give consent to God, you know, I have seen parents come out the other side saying, wow, thanks be to God, you know. And at the same time, it would be nice for parents to recognize that from the beginning. You know, and just to say, mm-hmm. son, we're praying for you to be open to a vocation in either direction. Because quite frankly, you know, I seldom encounter parents who are really resistant to their kids saying, you know what, I'm considering the armed services. I'm considering the armed forces. I'm thinking maybe about the Marines or the Air Force, the Navy, the Coast Guard, you know, just the Army.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, the sacrifices that are made in the natural order, you know, are essential for the survival of our nation. And so often that people are open to not only allowing their kids to pursue that, but applauding them when they do it, when they come back. You know, I was on a plane flight just on Saturday, and, you know, they said a former POW is in first class, and the whole plane broke into applause.
Mm.
And I joined them. But at the same time, I just wish that they had also known that a really holy priest was on that plane.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what would they have done then? I think they should have broken into greater applause, but of course nothing was said, nothing was done.
Mm-hmm.
There are sacrifices in the natural order. There are even greater sacrifices in the supernatural. And I would say, parents, if you really want what's best for your kids, you know, ask for more faith so that you might have a clearer vision that this might be the greatest thing of all for them.
Wow. Many Are Called is the name of the book, the new one by Dr. Scott Hahn. I wish we had all day. You are just this great font. But then we have the Scott Hahn, dare I say it, the Scott Hahn Library now that we all have access to be able to continue to glean from all of this. I just wish we had more time, Scott. Any final thoughts?
Well, I suppose it just has to do with the subtitle of the book, and that is Rediscovering the Glory of the Priesthood. You know, and caring about in our hearts this conviction that we might be the link in the chain. We might be the voice that God uses to kind of communicate a calling to a particular young man. He might be a neighbor. He might be a nephew. He might be, you know, a godson. He might just be the paper boy. But I think there's a way in which we can kind of open our hearts and recognize that if this young man has no attraction whatsoever to the priesthood, that doesn't tell me he's not called. It just tells me he hasn't understood the priesthood yet. Mm-hmm. Because to understand it is to see it as intrinsically desirable, as supernaturally attractive. And that creates the condition of possibility for a genuine response, for real, authentic discernment. And so I would just say, you know, I shudder to even speak the next sentence, but get a few copies of this book or some other book like it, because God is going to bring men like that into your lives, as he already has. And I think we need to have resources that will help young men kind of raise their awareness above the cultural din of our relativist society and just recognize, wow, there is a much higher calling than anything I've heard about up until now.
Beautiful. Many Are Called, Rediscovering the Glory of the Priesthood, Dr. Scott Hahn. Thank you so much for your time. And do say hello to that beautiful vocation of yours. I believe her name is Kimberly.
Oh, she is more beautiful every day. And the friendship just continues to grow and the fun as well. You say hello to that vocation of yours named Bruce. It is so much fun to be back together again with you. I just wish that we could do it in person.
Oh, me too. Maybe soon. Dr. Yes. Scott Hahn, God bless you for all your work. Keep it up. We need you.
God bless.
Okay, bye-bye. We've been going inside the pages of Dr. Scott Hahn's book, Many Are Called. Dr. Hahn's work can be found at salvationhistory.com or any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, please visit www.insidethepages.com. I'm Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.